Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Michelle Pawley and I'm sitting on Glastonbury Tor overlooking the Somerset Levels. I'm here with Beth Webb, the author of the epic Stardancer series of historical fantasy books for young adults, which are set in this region. Beth, why have you brought me here?
Because this is a place of absolute magic. Now, if you cast your eye across, you'll see how very, very flat the landscape is, and yet we are on this enormous hill that just rises up out of the flatness. Very, very strange, very magical place. Now, in the Iron Age, in fact up until the Middle Ages, all these flat fields we can see were like this in summer. That's where the word Somerset comes from, Zomerzetta, summer fields. But in winter, it would have been covered in brackish water. It would have been deep sea. And it was so deep that, in fact, just behind us on Wirral Hill that we passed when we came in, there is archaeological evidence that the Romans actually built a jetty there to take their boats.
And this is the setting for the first of the books in your series, Stardancer, isn't it?
Absolutely. I have always been fascinated by this magical nature of land, which is land in summer, and sea in winter. To the Iron Age people, this would have been a source of great wonder. It just seemed the perfect setting. And also, in a little bit, we're going to the Peat Moors Visitor Centre to see a reconstructed Iron Age village. And it is just a perfect place to imagine the past. 2,000 years ago, what would it have been like?
Stardancer is about a magical girl called Tegan who grew up on the edge of these levels. Did she come to Glastonbury at all in the book?
No, she doesn't, actually. Most of the book takes place at the bottom of the Mendips, those hills you can see just over there. And the piece I'm going to read you first is the view from there to here at night. Gilda did not need a lamp, for the brilliance of the night lit her way. The path from Clessick and Ness's cottage down to the village where she lived was long but not steep, winding through the leafless oak and hazel woods alongside a chattering stream. The sound kept her company. The wind was getting up and had a bitter edge. At a twist in the path, Gilda stood on an outcrop of rock overlooking the winter seas below. The black waters were roughened by the icy air, and the few muddy islets were charcoal smudges in the ebony landscape. Above, the stars were being rapidly covered with a thick pall of clouds as the silvered light was plunged into darkness. "It's almost like the stars don't want to be seen tonight," she muttered to herself. "I'm sure the child is important, but how? Perhaps something secret's going on." Again, ahead, she could faintly see the Tor, peat black as the goddess's breast, a lonely island rising out of the seas. Tonight, there were lights on the top of the sacred hill. So the druids were watching too. Then the spirits were about. Now, welcome.
We're now in the Peat Moors Centre, which is a reconstructed Iron Age village. We're sitting in the middle of it, underneath a tree, surrounded by three round houses, which look a bit like little mushrooms. Beth, this is the place which inspired Stardancer. Tell me why.
Well, as you can see, it's wonderful. Eddie and the people that have built this village have followed very closely the known archaeology. This is what it's firmly believed houses were like in Tegan's time. They are about 15 foot round, beautiful conical thatched roofs. I'll take you inside in a minute so you can see. But I often used to come here with parties of young people who I was teaching creative writing. And I would sit inside and I would talk about using the imagination and about time shifting and about imagining the past and imagining what people's lives were in places like this. Now, I already had the idea for Tegan and Stardancer pootling through my head. And as I was getting the children to use their imaginations, I found my own was clicking into gear. Let's go inside and I'll show you what I mean. This place has got everything. It's been constructed with a great deal of respect for archaeology.
And as you can see, this house has everything you could possibly want. It's a very cosy little bungalow. There's a beautiful bed over there, covered with sheepskins. And here in the middle is this lovely hearth on a raised beaten earth platform. Originally it probably had stones around it, which would be made very hot from the fire, and the fire would be going night and day whether it was cold or not, because that's how you heated water and cooked. And then these fire dogs here, they're quite authentic. They're built based on archaeological finds. It's a sort of H frame, beautifully twisted ironwork with a sort of fork at the top, and there's a pair on the other side. So it almost looks like deer with their heads. And these, as I say, are based on actual archaeology. And then there would have been a big iron bar put from one to the other, straight across like that, can you see? Mm-hmm. And you'd have skewered your goose or your pig or whatever and bit roasted it. And here, again, you can see hanging from the middle this beautiful black chain and then this lovely cauldron at the bottom. It's beautiful. It's like a real witch's cauldron, isn't it? And the way they would have cooked would put water in and get hot stones from the side, pop them in, boil the water, and then you pop your meat in and cooks beautifully. So much here is so fascinating. You've got the loom here with these weights at the bottom. You see, they're made out of clay, great big chunks of clay with holes in, which stretches the wool. And I don't know how to use this. I've seen it in use, but I'm not good enough at it. But there, hanging up, is a shirt, which it's how they would have kept their clothes rat-free and mice and mouse-free. Hang it up. And I just found it inspirational, looking and seeing a whole way of life in a place like this. Oh, this is interesting. You put your... This is called a saddle quern. It's a big piece of stone. You put your grain on here, and this is a big chunk of stone with a sort of slightly concave top. Put your grain in the concave and get another stone, like a seaside pebble, and you grind like this. Now, you had to do that for enough flour every day for your family. And then one day, somebody invented the rotary quern.
Hooray!
Actually, we had it before the Middle East, apparently. Now, this is like a big stone basin with another big stone basin on top. And you put your wheat in the middle, and there's a big handle at the side. Here we go. Can you see the flour coming out the side?
Mm.
Phew! Oh, and if the fire wasn't working, these are the actual bellows I used in Stardancer, when Tegan catches them on fire and splashes her father's face, gets splashed with silver. It's magic. See, it has a great big cow horn, and it's a big sack made out of leather with wooden handles at the top, and you press down on the handles, that squeezes the sack, and air comes out of the horn. Sounds like it's got asthma, doesn't it?
How important is it to you that they are rooted in this kind of historical accuracy?
Well, I have written books which are pure imagination, but actually this is much more fun. Because all sorts of little unexpected twists come. Now, look at this bed over here. Now, it's... they do have another bed here, which is a wooden frame, but this is just bundles of reeds on a wooden frame. It's a bit like a futon. And then just sheepskins on top. And I tried this bed out once. I sat in it and I thought, this is quite all right. I used this as Witten's bed in the book. And as I snuggled down under the sheepskins, all these great big black spiders came. And I thought, oh, right, I'll put those in the next book. One of my greatest pleasures while writing has been to look at all this wonderful reconstructed archaeology and imagine how people lived. In the book, the old druid Witten has died, and Tegan and Griff are left snowbound, midwinter, no one to help them, with a dead body. What on earth would they do? The ground is too hard to dig a grave. A corpse, even of a shriveled old man, is very heavy. And to drag it up to the funeral caves, which they use in the story, is just too much for two young people without help. And I looked around and I thought, what on earth would they do with a corpse? And then I looked at the bed covered with these magnificent sheepskins and I wrote this. And this is when Griff realises that old Witten is dead. "Is he gone now?" he asked. "Gone," she replied, willing herself to stretch out her hands to close Witten's eyes. He felt warm. Somehow she expected him to sigh and turn over, but she knew he wouldn't. "Come on, Griff, I'm going to need your help. Father will begin to smell soon, so we've got to put him outside. We don't want the wolves to get him, so we'll lay him on his bedskins and roll him up and sew it all together. Until the thaw brings the other white robes, we won't be able to take him to the caves, so he can travel to Tir na n'Og. But this will help to keep him safe." "Good," Griff agreed. "Safe is good." Together, they took the sheepskins and laid them end to end on the floor. Then, with Griff at the old man's feet and Tegan at his head, they lifted him down and rolled him into a cocoon. "I'll have to wait for morning," Tegan said. "It will be impossible even to thread the needle before there is daylight."
We're now looking into a second roundhouse. We can't go into it, but just looking through the door, it's dark, it smells musty. Beth, what did this inspire?
Well, this was actually the main roundhouse when I was writing the books, but it's falling down. Can you see great big cracks in the walls?
Oh, yes.
And the roof is falling in, and they've decided just to close it to visitors and see how it decays. It's a bit of experimental archaeology. But it's fascinating for me because in several of the books I mention these roundhouses falling down and people finding them half derelict. And so, of course, I have all my research just here. It's absolutely perfect. I would love to show you two things particularly over here which were very important in the book. Oh, mind that molehill. Now, if you look here, you can see how boggy the ground is. Now, this is what the land is like if it's not drained. And you can see how these molehills are thrown up peat. And here we have a magnificent dugout canoe. Now, although that didn't particularly come into this book, it does come into other books. But you see how it's just a tree trunk which has been shaped.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the summer it wouldn't have been much use, but in winter it would have floated. And it could have been used for going across the marshes, being shallow. Of course, it could get through the marshes very easily. Now, let me show you over here. Now, this once again, this lovely, lovely marshy bit here, and you can see how boggy it really was. This is what it would have been like before it was drained. Now, here, on our left, these are called trackways. Now, these do come into the book. And you see how it's just woven sticks and bundles of stick piled up, if you look down there, on the water.
Oh, I see. They do look a bit like train tracks as well, don't they?
They're
made out of stick.
They are. And it's just, you see, they're different. Over there, it looks just like sleepers laid sideways on. This is just a hurdle woven in and out. This is just bundles of sticks. And down here, you see pegs have been put into the ground, great big tree trunks being put into the ground to make an X. And then when the X crosses, they've laid split logs across the top. So that was a bit wobbly. In fact, they're all a bit wobbly. I have walked this trackway, but it's gone underwater now, so I can't do it, even for sound effects.
So this is how they would have coped with the wet weather and the flooding?
Yep, this was the M5. But in the book, Tegan tries to cross this terrain when she's fleeing, and I'm going to read you that bit now. Tegan fears she's going to be put to death for claiming to be the Star Dancer. She is just a 13-year-old girl, and all these very educated, rather snobbish druids are sort of saying, well, who are you? Why should you claim to be the Star Dancer? We know better than you. She doesn't know she has in fact been chosen to be the Star Dancer, and she wakes up and she thinks, I'm not ready to die. and so she tries to run away. To her right sprawled a forest of oak, hazel and ash, tangled and grim. Ahead spread the shallow waters of the winter seas, with the wooded trackway that crossed the marshy waters from her valley to the small humped islands of the south, then ran across the Tor and the hills. If she could get onto the track, she might be able to flee to safety. It was a dangerous path, just brushwood bundles, planks, hurdles lashed to poles. In this weather, it would be treacherous. Tegan shifted her feet in the sucking mud and then turned to see how far she still had to run to reach the beginning of her freedom. To her horror, she saw that although the trackway stretched across the water to her right, the first stage was submerged. She would have to wade. The shouts were coming closer. Her pursuers must be halfway across the meadow. Keeping low, she lifted her skirts and began to pick her way between the trees, using the latticed roots as a path. But as she came to the water's edge, there were no more trees, and the oozing mud was a treacherous soup. Behind her, the shouts were getting louder. She could hear the dogs yelping with excitement. Was that Griff's voice? She held her breath and listened. No, he would never betray her. Suddenly she slipped and found herself knee-deep in sucking slime. Icy water slurped and gurgled at her feet and legs, but fear gave her strength. She lunged towards a stand of rushes and pulled hard, praying that they would be deep-rooted. Slowly she eased her way forward until she found a firmer footing. She clambered onto a fallen ash tree and lay there, exhausted.
Now, your books are very much infused with a very deep sense of place, a very deep sense of this place, and part of that comes from your use of the physical landscape and also things like the light, the weather conditions. Why is light so important to you?
Partly, I think, because I'm also a visual artist. I've earned my living for many years as an illustrator. Light has a very transforming power. If you look at this village under snow, for example, it will be entirely different, or even in fog. I'm using fog in the next book. There's a passage which I'm going to read in a minute, which is about walking up the hillside. It's fairly near the beginning, and it's deep, deep snow. And if you look at the world in snow, it suddenly isn't where you thought it was. It becomes something entirely different. And when I was a child, my father used to teach my sister and I to look at a twisted tree and see a goblin in it, very much like Arthur Rackham's illustrations. And use of transforming one shape into another, it's actually called using a simulacrum, is such a wonderful game. You don't see a tree, you see a goblin. On the Mendip Hills, just behind us, there are large cracks in the ground. It's limestone, and over the centuries and millennia, these have been washed by rainwater, which washed away the cracks to make holes. Now, these holes are called swallets. It's not a word you'll find in any dictionary, but the root of it is to swallow. Swallet. And these holes are so big and so deep and so treacherous that modern cavers have actually found skeletons of people and cows, even, that have just fallen down the swallets, like this. And so the mythology that comes out of this sort of thing, it's all to do with transformation, transforming a tree into a goblin, transforming a hole into a mythical place, and light transforming the ordinary into the extraordinary. I'm going to read you a piece which is about this sense of legend and transformation, and it involves all three of these aspects. Tegan has just got her own adult name, and she's walking back up the hill with her mother. It's the middle of the night, and it's snowing. Nessa slowed. "I feel tired," she said. "You go ahead, I'll catch you up." "No," Tegan grasped her mother's hand firmly. "We're going home together." But every step they took forward seemed to slide them further and further into the mire. "We must get back. We will get back," she muttered between chattering teeth. They trod warily in the dark, lest they slip down a swallet, a bottomless hole in the ground where the hungry hill demons swallowed victims to sate their desire for lifeblood. Tegan knew these traps appeared in many places. Some said they were always in the same spot. Others thought the demons moved them around. even without the snow, holes like these would not always be visible. Everything seemed to change shape in the lantern light. Where trees and rocks had stood by daylight, now loomed giant's bones, empty eye sockets and shattered teeth. The meagre light skidded across the white icy softness. Tegan wished she could lie down and sleep as if the snow was a bed of goose feathers, but she knew that would be death. Nessa started crying. Tegan tightened her grip on her mother's hand just as the lantern flared up, spluttered and almost went out. The flame recovered, but she guessed there was very little candle left. She felt no emotion, just cold. It had grown past pain to become a throbbing numbness in her bones. The night was so silent and so strange. Had one of the demons already swallowed them whole?
Guardian Unlimited.